Hello, this is Peter with Let the Bird Fly. We're back with another Bird's Eye View episode. This is the first of another three-part series, which comes from a talk that Wade gave at St. John's Evangelical Lutheran Church in McGuanago, Wisconsin. You may remember Pastor Bordlin, a guest we've had on a couple of episodes. He's one of the pastors down there. In this talk, Wade walks us through an overview of the Reformation and some key points in Luther's life. He roughly follows the outline that Martin Brecht lays out in his three-volume series on Luther. The three parts of Brecht's Martin Luther series are Luther's Road to the Reformation, which is the years 1483 to 1521. The second part is Shaping and Defining the Reformation. The years are 1521 through 1532. And the third part is The Preservation of the Church, 1532 through 1546. So if I understand correctly, Wade followed those that break down roughly and kind of walks through that. The first part, therefore, will deal with Brecht's Luther's Road to the Reformation, the years 1483 to 1521. That's what you're about to listen to now. So thank you to St. John's McGuanago for asking Wade to present, and thanks also for letting him record so that we are able to share it with our listeners. If you enjoy Wade's talk, you may want to send St. John's a thank you as well. Enjoy the talk.
Well, thanks for having me down again. It's always fun to be able to be down. I was down a while ago for Galatians, and now to be down to get to talk about Luther a little bit. And I apologize for my voice. It's just been starting to go lately with the Reformation. There was a lot of preaching and teaching, and then basketball has started up again, so I'm coaching the boys, and so I spend a couple hours twice a week yelling at them. I know I sound a little bit like, if you remember the Brady Bunch, I think it was Peter Brady whose voice was changing, and they recorded the song, you know, When It's Time to Change. Kind of feel like that, but otherwise, hopefully I'll keep my voice for the time we have together today. Kind of wrestled with the best way to kind of go over what we're doing today, but the thought was to kind of give an overview of the Reformation and some of the key developments with Luther and his life, and then some of his thought and how it developed. So what I decided to do is I'm just going to kind of talk our way through, and don't worry, we'll get breaks. But for my outline, I'm kind of just going to break it into three parts. And I went into both your pastor's offices to see if they had these books, just out of curiosity. So maybe they have them at home, but I didn't see them. So if you're ever trying to think of a gift to give them, what I'll be using as an outline is just kind of how things are broken down by a man named Martin Brecht. He has a three-volume series on Martin Luther. As far as if someone wants a somewhat very readable but thorough overview of Luther's life in the Reformation, and you're ready to read, this first volume is, you know, 500 pages, so you're ready to read 1,500 pages. Brecht is a great way to go. I'm not going to try to get 1,500 pages into 3 hours. And to be honest, I haven't read Brecht in a couple years because I've been reading other stuff. But it's usually my go-to as far as if I need to know something somewhat precise about Luther and his life. So what he does is he has a first volume on Luther's early life through 1521, then 1521 through 32, and then 1532 through 1546. And so what I'm going to be doing is just kind of walking through some of the key developments or points from those time periods. And at any point, if you have questions, just feel free to stop me. I thought about PowerPoint, but there would have been way too many pictures to try to throw up, or way too much text I would have put up. And then I find myself just looking at the screen and not at you. So stop me at any point if I'm going too fast or losing you. What I don't want to be is too detail-oriented in what we'll be doing today. What I want to kind of give you is you're putting in a 3 hours. We're not going to go 3 hours. We'll have breaks in there. We won't go 3 hours straight. But you're putting in the time. I want to give you an overall impression of Luther's life and time and then the key teachings that emerge in that time. We just celebrated the anniversary of the Reformation, which is rather arbitrarily set as 1517, the Diet of Worms. In October 31st, but yesterday was also an important day for those who have an interest in Lutheran history. Yesterday was Martin Luther's birthday. So he is now, whatever 1483 is today, to today, he is now that age in heaven. At least we assume he's there. I don't know that his opponents throughout history have always wanted him there. But we still, you know, the issue will come up, well, how do we now, we've commemorated the Reformation, what do we do now? And Pastor Bordelon mentioned, I'm recording this, and we have a podcast we've been doing at the college. One of Pastor Bordelon's longtime friends and our new theology professor, Dr. Michael Berg, whose office is now next to mine, and Peter Hermanson, who is a guy who did grad school for philosophy, but his undergrad for theology, and then a friend of John and mine, Ben Lyer, who does our tech stuff and also has a background in theology. We have episodes we do, and then we have these little winging it sessions where we talk for half an hour on something. But we've been doing now, it's called Bird's Eye View, because we got to have a bird name for everything. That's the theme. Where we'll put these lectures up as we're able to, if I record them correctly, and that's always a big if, because usually Ben and Peter do the tech. But we were talking the other day, the last episode to come out was a Reformation postlude. And we were kind of talking about, now we've had the big synod celebrations, we've had all the, you know, the Luther bobbleheads and the knickknacks, whatever else. Maybe people have said this was the Reformation year, I'm going to read this or that, now what? And we kind of talked about what we hope would come out of this Reformation year. And as a Reformation historian, my view is we have something to commemorate every year for quite a while now. 1518, we have the Heidelberg Disputation, 500th anniversary of that, right? 1520s, all these big pamphlets. But I think the biggest thing, if we can get an overall impression of Luther and his thought today, would be that we as churches press forward with the one thing we have that no one else has to give the world, which is the message of the freedom of the gospel, the forgiveness of sins, and a great respect for the preaching and teaching of that. Christ crucified for sinners, and of course we qualify, right? But God comes and, I was just made a saint in a book before, and he declares us, makes us saints. And so with that in mind, I don't want to get lost in Luther's childhood, but just a little bit on his background so we can understand where he comes from and the times in which he's born. One of the big challenges when we talk about Martin Luther is historians love to break things into periods, right? Periodization. So this is the early Middle Ages. This is the high Middle Ages. This is the late Middle Ages. This is early modern. This is Enlightenment, you know, whatever the case may be. One of the problems with that is that no one living in 1400 said, I'm living in the Middle Ages. No one living during the time of Caesar Augustus said, we're living in antiquity. Now, we are somewhat cognizant. We do try to give names to our ages. We have generations now, Gen X, Gen whatever, iGen, whatever the case may be. But part of that's because we look back. The Middle Ages only have their name because the humanists, the Renaissance, said, well, now we're finally done with that stuff. We're going to go back to like what antiquity was. And that was just the time in between. So where does Luther fall? We tend to, when we think of this period historically, people will talk about Renaissance and Reformation. The honors course I teach at the college is still called RenRef, right? Renaissance and Reformation. But when we're talking about Luther, we have to recognize what he really is. He's living in a time that's kind of a bridge. He lives in a world that's still very medieval, and he holds ideas that are in many ways still very medieval, but he is going to give birth to thought and actually, you know, grab onto some emerging thought that will be what we can call early modern. It's not quite modern, but it's getting there, right? And so when we have these Luther anniversaries, people can latch onto all kinds of stuff. So you could have in the 1800s, national German Luther, you know, that this was a, you know, he was, German unification's finally happening with Bismarck, whatever, you know, Luther for the Germans. You could have in the 1700s, Enlightenment Luther, who was all about the conscience and freedom of conscience. In our own day, it's kind of hard. There's not any monolithic movement, you know, possible in a world that's as diverse and as big as it is today. But if Luther were thinking of his own time and what he is when he was born, you know, he's very much born into what we would consider to be the late Middle Ages. Right? There are people who are concerned still about someone casting a spell on them if you get into a dispute, right, someone's going to, you know, there's concerns and in the towns of Saxony, you know, about this. Luther can say, talk about a Wechselbachs or changelings, which they thought that if a child was born sometimes with a very large head or screaming a lot, what we would probably call some sort of sickness or disorder, that the devil had impregnated that woman, and so this could be a changeling. And Luther says, well, put it in the alba and see if it floats. You know, this is probably not advice any of us would take today. But he's also born at a time when capitalism is starting to emerge, and Luther has a great skepticism of capitalism. When we read Luther in my ethics course and get to economics, sometimes my students are somewhat taken aback. Luther does not sound what many of my students who maybe lean to the right politically or the homes they come from might think. When it comes to social welfare and things like this, he's very concerned with helping the poor, eradicating poverty, things of this nature. But he also is, you know, he comes out against interest, charging interest, and that was just the medieval view. You should loan someone something, you shouldn't charge interest. Anytime prices go up, he assumes someone's price gouging. It doesn't ever sink in, well, maybe there was just a bad harvest. Someone has to be doing something somewhere. And but his father is someone who is kind of a peasant emerging into the middle class. His mother comes from somewhat lower nobility, not with a lot of wealth, but a little better standing than his father. His father is a peasant who manages to actually buy some mines, to be a miner, and become somewhat wealthy. Right? He by the time he dies, you know, he probably would be the equivalent of a somewhat comfortable suburban life in our day, if you were going to put someone on the scale of where they, you know, there's still bills to pay. It's not as if, you know, they could go to Hawaii every winter, but somewhat comfortable, this emerging middle class. And coming with owning mines, though, and with capitalism is, right, a life in which there's constant debts, right? There's loans out to make the business work. There's, you know, scrapping to make sure you can build something special. And so Luther's raised in a home that is already going to be stern because it's a late medieval German home, but is also one that is focused on the family moving forward and upward. And so he has a stern upbringing, not abusive by any means. Some people, people at Luther's time did not write autobiographies. It was considered to be a rather arrogant thing to do. Erasmus thought it was kind of I think he even calls it a feminine thing to do, you know, to write about your own life, a silly, a trite thing to do. We tend to like autobiography, right? We want someone to write an autobiography. We like reading it. You know, Erasmus kind of pokes fun at St. Augustine's Confessions, which is one of the first true autobiographies, and says, yeah, I don't understand why Augustine ever wrote that. So most of what we know about the childhood of Luther or any of the reformers is from stories that were recorded that he told. And so he tells one story about his mother beating him pretty good for trying to steal, I think it was a nut or something. And then one account of his father using corporal punishment on him as well. And he said it took his father a few days to win him back. So Luther was angry at his father after this. Now, anyone who's ever had children knows sometimes even the littlest thing can take a few days to ease out with an adolescent, whatever the case may be. Corporal punishment was just kind of the order of the day in the schools as well. And any of us who were raised in a home, you know, that maybe had spankings if, you know, at a certain point, know that is not something that necessarily had to be incongruent with your parents loving you, right? In fact, sometimes maybe they even say this is going to hurt me more than you, and you'd say, yeah, right. But then you'd look and you could see in their face, this is not what mom and dad wanted to be doing. So it was a stern home. It's a strict home. It's a home that's about the family's future. You know, think to America's past. the big push for the middle class when the middle class was growing. And this is going to be the first, we're going to send our kids to college, or our kids are going to, right, the next generation is going to do better than us, and we're going to build something. And the importance of the family name and things of this nature, you know, those of us who had blue-collar parents, you know, fathers who went off and worked 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and they weren't just doing it to go be at work. They were doing it because they wanted to be able to give their family, their children, a better life. And this is the case with Luther's upbringing. His upbringing seems to have been religious for the day, but not fanatical by any means. He was baptized on St. Martin's Day, and so he's Martin Luther. He is raised going to church. But there's nothing to say that he was early on set on a path to be a monk. There's a book, I think it came out in the 50s, where, is it Erik Erikson, I think is his name? This is a terrible book from a historical perspective, and it really largely got panned academically. But he tries to psychoanalyze Luther, like Freudian style, which is always, you know, difficult to do over the span of 500 years. But he comes up with, you know, Luther had all these Freudian complexes that led him to the monastery. His friends seem somewhat surprised when he makes this decision to go in the monastery. He is educated fairly well for the schools that were available at the day. He has schools that he writes about or speaks about that he detested, he hated. I think Mansfeld, for instance, he talks about it was pretty much just good for getting beatings. And you would be required to memorize things. And at the end of the day, for whatever you messed up, there would be punishments. You would have a student who was the Lupus or the Wolf, who was supposed to snitch everybody out. If you were the worst student for the day, some schools would have the equivalent of the dunce cap. Maybe you've heard the expression ass hat before. That came from you would have to wear the donkey ears, right? You had the donkey ass hat. For the day. And that was meant to be motivational. Motivational how? You didn't want to wear it again after you wore it once, right? It wasn't one of the things you looked forward to. But it wasn't, this was not modern pedagogy in any way. This was very much rote, systematized. You do this or else. And there's elements of that still in education, but we recognize that learners tend to flourish a little more in a less threatening environment on the whole. Now, that anybody who's ever been around a bunch of kids realizes quickly the temptation to fall back on you do this or else, though, right? Especially if they greatly outnumber you and they just won't stop talking. But he has certain schools that he held dear, certain teachers that he speaks well of later in life. And his education would have been, like any education, largely focused on the languages. Language, rhetoric, music, right? You would have been involved in choirs. This is where we'll talk about Luther singing for bread, right? The students would often go around and sing or carol, things like this. It appears that when he was at the school in Magdeburg, he's introduced to what was called the Brothers of the Common Life and some of the what will later be called the Via Moderna, and you can forget that, but these schools of philosophy that are kind of competing at the time. But eventually, he is on his path to university, and the important part for us is going to be he ends up enrolling at the University of Erfurt. And Erfurt was one of the leading cities of Germany at this time, and we have to remember what cities were at this time. McGuanago would be a huge city. Like this, I don't know what population is now, but when I drive in, the sign says 7,000, right? Erfurt maybe was about 20,000, and this was very big. Wittenberg was much smaller than McGuanago. Wittenberg, if anybody's ever been there, had a main street, right? And the university, everything's on the street. But Erfurt would have been large for the time. It was called the City of Spires. It's filled with monasteries and churches. Known for its monasteries and churches. It is a beautiful city. Economically, it suffered since World War II. It was in the East, and the communists didn't necessarily put a lot into making cities vibrant. You know, when they did build, it tend to be big, square, modern buildings that were efficient, but, you know, not necessarily inspiring. But but beautiful city, and he's going to study law. And his father buys him this hugely expensive law textbook that would come with that. This is a huge investment that the family is making. If you ever look at what college costs, right? It was expensive then too. And the reason for law was important. If you were going to improve the family, if you were going to advance, you did not go to school for business at this time. At our college, the big things, right, are business and nursing right now. The merchant class, this was not, you could make money as a merchant, but this was not necessarily considered a, you know, business was not necessarily a stable, respectable, what it is today. You would go, if law was probably the preeminent way to go, maybe medicine too, but definitely law. You could be a lawyer, you could work in a court, you could be an advisor, you could teach. This was the versatile degree. And Luther starts off and he is a average student. You know, he's not doing the best in his class. He's not doing the worst. But things are proceeding apace. And what we know, right, what changes everything is going to be a near-death experience. And Luther had had a couple. He's traveling with a friend at one point, and they're carrying a sword. Traveling was a dangerous thing, especially the route they would have to go oftentimes was through the forest. And I can't remember if it's Luther or if his friend gets cut, right, by the sword. They were students, not swordsmen. You know, this is like giving a hammer to a pastor. Bad things can happen, but I don't know, Mike, are you really handy or, okay. You know, work day, they always limited what tools I could use. My wife still gets nervous when I have the chainsaw. But the big thing is gonna be a thunderstorm. And we think thunderstorms and we think, what's the big deal? Some of us like watching thunderstorms even, right? And it's a nice thing to do from the safety of your house or a camper or work or even your vehicle. But have you ever been out on the open water or maybe on a hike when a storm starts to roll in? And there's a sense of panic that you wouldn't otherwise have. And especially if you're walking in the dark on a path where you can easily lose your way. You feel it in your gut. Now imagine lightning striking right around you. And you have no scientific conception of how lightning works. You just know it's really bad and you don't want to get hit by it. It could be a sign of God's anger. They did know sometimes you'd put things on churches on high buildings to draw the lightning away, whatever. But this is a terrifying event. And it's life or death, it feels like. Luther appeals, as any good Catholic would have at that time, to a saint. And he appeals to Saint Anne. And there's all kinds of speculation why Saint Anne, and that's for another day, and I'd have to do more research to remind myself. Saint Anne was supposed to be the mother of Mary, right? And there's some connection in Germany and where Luther was raised, I think, to Saint Anne. There are certain saints that are just more prominent in someone's upbringing. I grew up in the Catholic Church, and I remember being at my sainted grandmother's house, who's now in heaven, and God bless her, and is extremely sincere. But we learned pretty early on, don't tell grandma if you lose something. We would be at grandma's with my cousins playing all the time. We'd go down in the basement and play, and if she heard we lost something, she was coming down with her St. Jude prayer cards, and we were going to have to stop everything and pray to St. Jude. And so we quickly learned, let's just look for it ourselves. We might get it done quicker. And if we were going to go somewhere, in my family growing up, you know, St. Christopher was always someone who was emphasized for travel. There's some saints who might be important elsewhere who weren't even on my radar. I went to St. Robert Bellarmine for school. So St. Robert Bellarmine, who wrote against the Lutherans, ironically, was always on my radar. local saints. So Father Solanus Casey, who's on his way to sainthood, was a priest in Detroit, is very big in Detroit, right? This is, if you're a Detroit Catholic, this obviously Marquette University is named after a Jesuit missionary, right? These things can shape you. So St. Anne is in his mind for whatever reason. And he says, help me, St. Anne, and I'll become a monk. Why become a monk? Why not just, I'll give a little money to whatever. Well, in the medieval system, if you wanted to live a holy life, if you were going to live a life for God, you needed to withdraw and take up a vocation. Growing up Roman Catholic, if someone said, have you thought about vocations, they meant, have you thought about being a priest or a nun? Right? Now, in Lutheranism, and this is something you need to have Dr. Berg down for, who'd be much better than me. He gives about as good of a vocation talk as anybody I know. In Lutheranism, you all have vocations. Father, mother, employer, employee, this is all imbued with spiritual purpose and meaning because God has called you by baptism to serve your neighbor when and where he's put you. This is a radical thing Lutheranism does. It says God doesn't call you out of the world. God impels you into it to serve your neighbor. But in Luther's mind would have been, if I am going to devote my life to God, then I need to go into holy orders, right? I need to become a monk. And so he makes this vow. And lots of people probably made vows like this. Vows were taken seriously, but we've all made vows. I remember standing at the free throw line in grade school and saying, Lord, if I should ask out so-and-so, have me make this free throw. And then I make the free throw. And there was no way I was asking her out. I was a loser, right? But it just seemed like something. Or, mom and dad, if you just get me this, I'll never ask for anything again. You asked for something again. Don't even. If the Lions just win the Super Bowl once, God, I'll never whatever. I guarantee if they win, I'll still ask for things. It's just the way we are. But Luther takes it seriously. And so he made this vow and he survives and he gets back to Erfurt and he sets himself on finding a monastery. And if you wanted to find a monastery, Erfurt was the place to be. It was full of them. I remember once I was translating some Luther for a publishing house. And Luther kept talking about, what was the German? I think it was Barfüße Mönchen, the barefoot monks. He really didn't like these guys, these barefoot monks. I'm trying to figure out, what has he got against these barefoot monks he keeps ranting about? Well, then I was in Erfurt with some buddies once, and we were walking around, and we were going to bars, I'm not going to lie, and in moderation, right? But right down the street from the monastery Luther joined was the barefoot monks. There were rivalries. Probably, right? The barefoot monks, Luther would see them out and about, and they'd say, nice sandals. We're barefoot because we love Jesus. Church league basketball, probably the Augustinians stomped on their toes, and whatever the case may be. But there's all kinds of monasteries in Erfurt. And the one Luther chose is going to tell us something about where he's at this point. The Augustinian monastery in Erfurt, there's two important things, I think, for why he joins them. First, they have a relationship with the university to some extent. There's an emphasis on learning. In fact, his superior in the order, Johann von Staupitz, will be one of the first theology professors at Wittenberg. Secondly, it's an observant order, meaning they were about keeping the rules. Non-observant meant it was a little bit easier. Observant meant you dot your I's and cross your T's. And so Luther, as with many things in life, if he was going to be a monk, he was going to be a monk. Right? If he was going to live for God, he was going to live for God. And so this monastery he joins, there will even be in the Augustinian order a big debate about the observance versus the non-observance. And Luther will go to Rome as part of the observance to complain about the non-observance and saying everybody should be more observant. So he is serious about this, and it's the only time he leaves Germany, by the way, is this long pilgrimage to Rome. Otherwise, he spends pretty much all of his life essentially in the metro Milwaukee area. You know, a big trip for him would have been coming from WLC to Muguanago. Part of the reason is because he was an outlaw after Worms and he could have been put to death if he left Saxony, right? So this just wasn't a smart idea to be traveling around. He'll go to Heidelberg, which will be another longer trip, but still in Germany, but largely he's going to be in a set area. And this Augustinian order will then be important. A third thing, which doesn't necessarily tell us a lot about Luther at the time, but will be important in the long run, is that the Augustinian order gets its name from St. Augustine. Augustine, by the way, was my confirmation name. When I got confirmed in the Catholic Church, everybody was being Peter, because Peter's number one in the Catholic Church, right? Peter, the Pope. And I'm like, I'm going to be different. And this tells you my level of commitment. So I went and got a book of all the saints and made it into the A's all the way to AU before apparently I got lazy. Said, I'll just pick Augustine. I had no idea who Augustine was. But now I get a big kick out of picking what's one of my favorite theologians from antiquity by pure chance, right? Sometimes God, you look back and you say, ah, that was a pretty funny one, God. That worked out well. But this means that Luther will end up, the Augustinian order wasn't always reading Augustine by any means, but he'll end up reading St. Augustine. And St. Augustine was the great champion of grace in the battle versus Pelagius. A man named Pelagius basically said, you know, baptism, we've got a clean slate and we can pretty much get to heaven by works then. And Augustine's going to say, no, we need God's grace to be saved. Augustine, everybody claims Augustine on the doctrine of election. But Augustine is clear that God elects or calls people to faith, right? That preaching does something. And this is all stuff that will become formative for Martin Luther in the monastery. As he's in the monastery, he is ordained a priest. He's terrified to a certain extent of celebrating the Mass. You know, the story is that supposedly he spilled the chalice to some extent. Who knows if that's true or not? Definitely his hands are shaking, right? I think part of that story is the Luther movie shows that, right? But the big thing that happens when he celebrates his first Mass is his dad shows up. And his dad basically says, you're such a learned monk, have you never learned the fifth commandment? Honor your father and mother. Luther had made a vow and gone into the monastery after his dad had sacrificed his whole life for Luther to have a path in life. And this will always tug at Luther's conscience. And we have to be somewhat understanding with Hans, his father. His son becoming a monk meant no grandbabies. No furthering of the family name. Ironically, all this stuff would happen, right? He'd get grandchildren and the family name couldn't have been any more well-known. It's perhaps the most well-known name in Europe at the time. Not always in a positive way, but well-known. But even then, Luther's first Mass is tinged with, right? I chose this holy thing. I chose this thing to please God. But did I also displease God in what I chose to do? Luther eventually is going to realize everything we do is tinged with sin, even our best works, right? But when you're trying to climb the ladder to heaven, this can be something that really bothers you. Paul brags in the epistles, if anyone was ever a Pharisee, it was me. I was a Pharisee of Pharisees. I was the best Pharisee. Luther will boast, if anyone was ever a monk, it was me. Look, if you want to tell me about monkish holiness, he's going to say, okay, here, out-monk me. And by all accounts, he was. He would leave the confessional and go back in because he remembered something. And Staupitz eventually says to him, basically, you've never confessed anything even remotely interesting. And those of us who are pastors who have ever heard a confession know sometimes you kind of hope, I hope it's at least interesting. It's been a long day. I've been here 12 hours. You know, hopefully it's at least interesting. And sometimes you have people come in and they confess, and I would have to say to them, Jesus died for fake sins too. You know, they were so troubled by something that wasn't even a sin, but it burdened their conscience, so I would absolve them of something that wasn't even a sin. Luther is in and out of the confessional. He is wrestling with his sinfulness and with his sin and his standing before God. And anytime that's how you live life, as much as you want to love God, the more you try to conjure that love for him, you can almost sometimes end up hating him, angry at him, because he's this taskmaster who is responsible for all this torment, this anguish that you're putting yourself through. Guilt is a terrible, powerful thing. And even as we become perhaps more irreligious as a society, I don't think we are becoming more irreligious. We're becoming maybe less Christian. But, you know, sometimes people will say, too, we're becoming more immoral. I don't think we're becoming more immoral. We just are trading moralities. We have more laws than we've ever had before, right? It's just we're changing what supposedly is moral or not. So Luther will say, the theologian of the cross calls a thing what it is. Theologian of glory. Well, we just have a theology of glory today. New words you can say, new words you can't, this and that, whatever the case may be. But life and guilt and unaddressed guilt is a tormenting thing. How many addictions don't go back to wrestling with guilt, trying to medicate guilt? How many broken relationships aren't broken because of guilt? Right? Someone shuts down. It can just heap on top, mental anguish can just be increased with guilt. And all the great reformers go through periods of melancholy. All the great Reformation artists go through periods of melancholy. Albrecht Dürer has a wonderful painting. So does Kronecker. I think both have paintings entitled Melancholia. Right? We'd call that depression. But this is, he's wrestling with this. And so Staupitz says we got to do a few things to get Luther to stop thinking about himself all the time. Not in a selfish way, he wasn't thinking about himself, but to be analyzing himself. We've got to get him out of his belly button. And so he says, Luther, you're going to go study biblical theology. And Staupitz, it was a wise man. Staupitz never becomes a Lutheran, but there's no Luther as we know him without Staupitz. And Staupitz says, you're going to study biblical theology. You're going to read the Bible. Now, sometimes we hear this story, the Bible was chained up in the Roman Catholic Church. It was. You know why? So no one would steal it. Because a Bible costs a year's salary sometimes. So it wasn't that you couldn't read the Bible. No one was going to slap a monk's hand if he went and got the Bible. But it was an expensive book, and there weren't a lot of them. And the lay people weren't going to read it because it was written in Latin. That was the Vulgate translation, and they definitely weren't going to read the Greek. And most of the lay people couldn't read the German. So Luther's going to study biblical theology, but the other thing Staupitz is going to do is just give Luther some advice finally and say, you need to find your peace in the wounds of Christ. You say, Lord Jesus Christ, save me. Stop hanging around in your belly button, Luther. Look to Christ. And there was a great tradition of this in the Middle Ages. Bernard of Clairvaux, for all of his warts and his devotion to Mary and his fondness for crusades, was a wonderful preacher of the cross. Google Bernard of Clairvaux later and do a Google images search, and it's hard to find him not pictured with a big old cross. Luther loved reading Bernard. Right? Some of the mystics, Tauler and others, right? There was this tradition of this focus on the Passion of Christ. But Staupitz then sows the roots for Luther's preaching of the gospel and then puts Luther in contact with the word, to which Luther will say at Worms, he's become captive. And so Luther will end up studying for his doctorate in theology at Wittenberg. And Wittenberg is a new university. Frederick the Wise had founded it. He's trying to make Wittenberg a more important city. It's smaller than WLC at this time. Definitely didn't have as nice a campus or a parking center. But it's they want to grow the university. Staupitz becomes one of the first theology professors there, and Staupitz, it seems, probably had in mind Luther would take his place eventually. So Luther's going to study biblical theology, which means he's going to spend a few years immersed in the Word. And not just Luther's training in theology before this had been thorough. He had been trained in a lot of theology, but in many ways how you were trained in theology at that time was that you read books about theology. So you read books that said, how do you handle this situation if this situation arises? How do you interpret canon law on this? How do you hear a confession? How do you die well, ars moriendi, things of this nature? Now he's going to go to the source. And this is something that's marked the Lutheran Church, right? We want preaching from the source. We want teaching from... Now, I'm not going to give you any... I'm not quoting the Bible at all today. But I'm talking about history. Right? But on Sunday, I'm guessing you expect Pastor Martin or Pastor Bordelon to give you the goods from the Word, right? Or at least tell a nice story about their kids or whatever they do now. I heard there used to be really good sermons once a month, but the but Luther's going to end up then now in a university setting as a professor in which he's still preaching a lot, so he's still serving pastorally, still a monk. He actually is going to be somewhat moving up the ladder of the Augustinian order, so he's overseeing a number of monasteries. The sheer amount of studying, preaching, writing, and administrative stuff that Luther was doing is mind-boggling, and it helps explain his poor health later in life. The fasting and stuff in the monastery, too, we tend to think it's part of what wrecked his digestive tract later in life. Like any good theologian, Luther later would have kidney stones. He famously battles constipation throughout his older life. The treatment for it is only worse, right? Supposedly, sometimes they would treat constipation by having you eat horse manure because it worked for the horse. It went through the horse. Maybe it would go through you. I won't get into the talk of the catheters and things of this nature that they used. Just his later health, probably in many ways shaped by his asceticism in the monastery, and then also just the sheer amount of work he's doing at this time. Even many scholars, their eyesight would just be wrecked later in life because of all the studying by candlelight. And if you've ever read With Not Great Light, these were, I believe Abraham Kalloff, a later Lutheran, talked about being a scholarly athlete, right? This was considered, you are the same as the bodybuilder is going and you are putting everything into learning. And so Luther's at the university, and I think if it's all right with the pastors, we're about 40 minutes in. I said we maybe take a 10-minute break at 40 minutes. We've got him at the university, and maybe we can pick up from there. Does that work? Yeah, question? Sure, why don't we do that? Yeah. Any questions so far, and then we'll take a break and pick up with the next section. Yes?
So in Erfurt, there's all these monasteries, and where did all the money come from?
That is a very good question, and people who do social history or economic history are always very interested in this. How did the monasteries in Erfurt get all their money? From the lay people, right? A, they would have endowments, money that had been given in the past. Anybody involved in higher education knows how important an endowment can be. But some of these orders were mendicant orders, Franciscans, for instance, and these were begging orders, meaning they had taken vows of poverty, so they weren't supposed to have a lot of wealth themselves, so they would go out and beg. The number of churches and monasteries in Erfurt did sometimes really stir some anti-clerical, anti-priest and monk sentiment, because it was a drain on the economy. And this is part of the Reformation economically, right, is going to change things drastically too, because money that before was being sunk into monasteries or giving of alms, right? In the Middle Ages, they would say, we need the poor because they take our money, they take our good works to heaven. In other words, poor Lazarus is gonna say, hey, Wade gave me some money. Jesus, he's all right. After the Reformation, Luther's going to say, how about we just try to alleviate poverty now that we don't need the poor to do good works to get to heaven? How about we try to... So they come up with the common chest, which gives out interest-free loans to people who are trying to start a business. Your house burns down, it helps you, right, be able to rebuild it. So this was part of people were drawn to the Reformation for a variety of reasons, and this is a very good question. But part of it was some people did recognize there's all the, in some places the church owns more than half of the property in a land. Just imagine how far can you go economically when that's the case? You know, there's big fights about developing in any city with what do you do with this land? Now I saw the, you know, now they're arguing over what the Bradley Center area should be after it gets taken down, and some want a dog park and park, and some want, you know, more development. I just want some of the police from downtown to come to my neighborhood once in a while. But, you know, maybe they can take the trolley out. But this was a large part of the money people had would have been going to the church. And this is why sometimes too, if some of the monks were looking, you know, a little bit too robust like me, people would wonder, you're supposed to be focused on fasting and prayer and service for our salvation. Right, the monk is not only working for his own salvation, but they're hopefully going to have an abundance of righteousness that will abound over for the city. You're supposed to, if you're a priest, be saying masses for the dead. You look like you've maybe had your focus more on the meals, right? And so you could have a lot of tensions that would arise from this, and they do arise in Erfurt at times. And Luther, interestingly, did not pick one of the monasteries that would have been he picks one where he's going to be focused on study, prayer, and service. Very good question. And this is a growing field kind of in historical study to look at social history, how this impacts, how is this all working on the down, on the basic level. Pastor.
You mentioned this pilgrimage to Rome and also conducting the first mass. What was the timeline of those events?
Oh, now you're going to get me with dates. I always tell my students I made it all the way through grad school without ever having to really memorize dates. The trip to Rome is going to be fairly early. I'll look this up. Or here, 98. So I don't want to misspeak, especially if it's being recorded. People will have no respect for my scholarship. He's taking a while getting into it. I think we're looking at like 1511, 1512.
The pilgrimage came before he his first mass. Is that the order of it?
They're coming. They're going to be, yes. The he would have been a novitiate and then I think was ordained pretty soon after being installed in the order. So. 1506, he's granted permission to prepare for the priesthood. So probably a span of 4 years or so in between there. And this, the trip to Rome just briefly is going to be important in part because Luther is going to be shocked by what he sees there. And this was the experience of almost anyone who took a pilgrimage to Rome. Prostitutes in the streets calling out for the monks or the priests, all kinds of selling of trinkets, if you were a priest, you wanted to say a monk, a mass at some of the various churches, especially the Lateran churches, and there's a long line, and you better say a quick 5-minute mass, which you can say a real quick mass if you, right? Not every mass has to have a sermon, and, you know, if it's private, your communion yourself, but you're saying your mass, and the next guy's saying, come on, hurry on already. supposedly climbing the Spanish steps on his knees for an indulgence for his grandparents, and wondering, you know, who knows if this is the case. Later on, I believe it's Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit order, someone begs him not to go to Rome because they know what it will do to his faith. So I think Luther later, you know, some of the language he uses about that trip, it just makes plain it. Here you have a whole system based on the holiness of the people who are in holy orders. And you go to the capital of that, this system of works that are supposed to help us get to heaven, and you see open immorality. Right? And rumors of the popes, you know. The Renaissance popes were very good popes when it comes to rebuilding Rome, sponsoring the arts. If you go to Rome and you see Michelangelo stuff, that's the Renaissance popes. They were also not always all that religious or theologically inclined, which is something now people tend to expect of a pope, you know, be a religious guy. You know, Alexander VI famously has a number of illegitimate children, and he's appointing them to positions in the church. Machiavelli, if you ever read Machiavelli, The Prince, Machiavelli is important because he kind of writes about how to be a leader and just leaves religion out of it. He says Alexander VI was a great pope because he never told the truth to anyone, and he, right? He's saying you should lead like him. Well, when my students read that, they'll go, he sounds like a bad pope. So, well, yeah, it depends what you mean by what a pope should be doing, right? So the Rome trip will be extremely troubling for him in that. As far as being a priest, obviously that will shape him for the rest of his life, because while Luther is a professor and theologian, he's in a pastoral setting, right? He is regularly preaching. He has people coming to him for confession. He is giving pastoral counsel. So his theology, I just wrote something, which hopefully will be coming out on 1517. They put posts up there, but on being an occasional theologian and how everybody should be an occasional theologian. Luther was an occasional theologian. An occasion came up and he applied theology to it. He never just thought back and speculated. We should not be abstract theologians. By nature, we all want to be abstract theologians. What is God like? Huh. I think God is like this, and I'm going to work my way to heaven. No, an occasional or concrete theologian starts where God has revealed Christ, right, in the manger and beyond. And so, and his theology is rooted in the parish. That's why I like getting together with the brother still and talking, preaching, and parish stuff to keep me rooted in the parish. Because when theology just becomes a thing that you do to have some clean system, like doing math, then it loses its beating heart, which is Christ for sinners, right? And so Luther as a priest will be exceedingly important for that. Is that a question?
How old is Luther at this time that he first takes his leadership role?
Well, so 1483, 17, he becomes a priest around 06, 07. Mid-20s.
Relatively young man.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, yeah, you know, I would say it's, you know, in his 30s is when a lot of the big stuff is starting to happen. So younger than me and Pastor Bordelon now.
Yeah.
Right. So relatively old, not necessarily that young for that time, right? We've pushed back adulthood quite a ways in America today. You know, I can watch college football and say, oh, that kid's pretty fast. For most of human history, that ain't a kid. He's maybe even been in a few wars already. He's probably got kids of his own, right? So for his time, his productive years were about where the productive years should be at that time. There just wasn't a lot to help you be as productive as we can be for as long in our day. Coffee and... you know, not eating manure and stuff like that. So, well, if we have any more questions, maybe we can pick them up after. Well, why don't you mentioned maybe 10 minutes, Pastor, you said, or Pastor Martin. I don't care which one of you wants to pick, but. All right, so we'll be back in at about 10:10.